This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies of the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Doc Watson is one of America's most revered folk musicians. For much of his career, he performed and toured with his son, Merle. Merle died in 1985 in a farm accident, just days before Fretz magazine named him finger-picking guitarist of the year in folk, blues, or country music. An annual concert in North Carolina honoring Merle, Merle Fest, wrapped up a few weeks ago. We'll be listening to Terry's 1988 interview with Doc, and we'll hear some songs recorded in a 1989 studio concert. Let's begin with a track from a new collection of songs Doc and Merle recorded in the 1980s called Sittin' Here Pickin' the Blues. This is Blue Ridge Mountain Blues.
Young and in my prime, I left my home in Caroline, and now all I do is sit and pine for all the folks I left behind. I've got them Blue Ridge Mountain blues, and I stand right here and say my grip is packed to travel. I'll be scratching gravel for that Blue Ridge far away. I can see two heads of snowy white, and in their window there's a light. It seems I can hear them both recite, oh, where is our wandering boy tonight? I've got them Blue Ridge Mountain blues, and I'll stand right here and say my grip is packed to travel, soon be scratching gravel for that Blue Ridge far away.
Doc Watson is the guitarist who's usually called the single finest flat picker in the country. The only argument you're likely to get about that is from people who don't want to praise his playing at the expense of praising his singing. He was born in Deep Gap, North Carolina. His father was a musician, though not a professional performer, and he got his son to play as well.
Didn't your father make the first banjo that you played?
Yeah, he did. That was in the summer of 1934. Made my first little stringed instrument. I had a harmonica before that. But Dad showed me a few of the old-time Fralin or Clawhammer banjo-style tunes, and one day he brought it to me and put it in my hands and said, "Son, I want you to learn to play this thing real well. Some of these days we'll get you a better one," he said. Might help you get through the world.
And what was it like for you the first time you got the banjo into your hands? What did you do with it?
I really don't remember. I remember how I felt, but I don't remember hardly what it was like learning the first tunes. It was kind of hard for Dad to show me because I couldn't see his hands, and it was a little tough. But he finally got across to me how to do the licks on the banjo and how to note the thing. And I could figure out where the notes were because it was fretless, and you could slide along with your fingers, and finally you'd come to the right one, you know, and you found out how to get there without missing them.
So you were really pretty self-taught.
For the most part, yes, I was. The guitar, absolutely, I was self-taught.
How did you get your first guitar?
By pulling the crosscut saw that I mentioned at first. One spring, my dad told my youngest brother and I, "Boys, if you'll cut all those dead chestnut, small dead chestnuts down along the road and around the edge of the field there, you can sell it for pulpwood to the tannery." And we went at it, and we cut a couple of big truckloads. It didn't make us a mint of money, but it made me enough to buy me a good little guitar from, well, I thought it was good at the time, from Sears Roebuck. And my younger brother ordered him a suit of clothes.
Now, considering that your early instruments were homemade banjos and a mail-order guitar, did you ever get really obsessed with the quality of instruments that you were playing? Some musicians just play what they have, and others get really obsessed with having instruments that are just right for them or custom-made for them?
I was fairly contented with what I had. I never had had my hands on a good guitar back in those days and didn't for years. The first good guitar that I got hold of that I would have considered much better than my mail-order box was a Martin guitar that Richard Green used to have a little music store under his, he had a boarding house or an inn there in Boone. And I went in there one day with that little mail order thing, and he said, "Why don't you let me help you get you a good guitar?" And I said, "Gosh, it costs too much." And he said, "I'll tell you what I can do. I can get you a good Martin D18 that will be a price that you can afford, and I'll take the payments down to $5 a month." And I couldn't beat that. I paid it off quicker than that, but I couldn't beat that with a stick. And at that time, I was playing at the little fruit stand and a little bean market they had in Boone, and making me a few shekels on Saturday, having a good time of picking, and I paid for the guitar that summer. He got me that thing at his cost, and it cost $90, and I paid for it. Oh, Lord, I was proud of that guitar. But in all truth, compared to my guitar now, it was like fretting a fence. It was really hard to play.
Well, I guess it's almost good in a way to get used to something like that, because it makes it seem so much easier when you get a good guitar.
Oh, it really does. And when I got into the folk revival in the 60s, I ran into people who could set a guitar action up to where you could play it, and I came on to another Martin along about that time. Played a Gibson at first on the road, borrowed. Then I came into another Martin, and the action was brought down to where you could play it.
My guest is Doc Watson. You know, I'm glad you brought up the folk revival. It was really during the folk revival that you started to become nationally known. I think you'd been playing dances and you know, playing
I played
in
rockabilly
your area.
Music through the 50s and played an electric guitar, Les Paul.
Well, see, this really interests me. You were playing rockabilly and an electric guitar.
Mm-hmm. Rockabilly and old pop standards with an old boy named Jack Williams. Jack had a little group together, and when he heard me pick, he said, "Buddy, I want you to pick with me."
Now, the way I understand it, Ralph Rinsler, who was working at the Smithsonian Institute, came down looking for traditional Southern musicians, came down your way and heard about you.
He was looking for Clarence Ashley and found him, Clarence Tom Ashley. And I had played music with Tom on a few land sales and a few little shows here and there. And Ralph came over, and when he heard me, he persuaded me over my better judgment at the time that I had something to offer in the way of entertainment in the folk revival. So I jumped in there with both hands, I reckon, thinking, well, if I fail at it, it won't mean I didn't try.
Doc Watson speaking with Terry Gross in 1988. Doc Watson returned to Fresh Air the following year for a concert.
When the late Jimmy Rogers did his last sessions in the early 30s, he did some music that sat right in the edge of the big band music of that day. Well, here's a pretty little tune old Jim recorded called Blue Eyed Jane. The sweetest girl in the world lives in my hometown. We fell in love like turtle doves. While the moon was shining down, I asked her then, I asked her when the wedding bells would ring. And she said, oh dear, it seems so strange for this to happen here. She is my sugar pie. Oh, to me she is the sweetest gal. I love her so, my blue-eyed Jane. And when the sun goes down and the shadows creeping over town, she meets me in the lane, my blue-eyed Jane. Pretty Jack.
listen here, Janie dear, I've come to say farewell. Sweetheart, you know I love you so much more than there's words to tell. But I must go away today, honey, won't you come with me? 'Cause I'm gonna be blue, missing you, longing every day for you, my blue-eyed Jane. Hold to me, you are the sweetest thing. I love you so, my blue-eyed Jane. And when the sun goes down and the shadows creeping over town, please meet me in the lane, my blue-eyed Jane. And when the sun goes down and the shadows creeping over town, then I'll come home to you, my blue-eyed Jane.
Once you went on the road during the folk revival, now you weren't used to traveling. There must have been a lot you learned had to learn how to do. Did you have a business manager to help you out with bookings? And
Ralph Frenzler did the bookings between he and Manny Greenhill of Folklore Productions. But Ralph traveled a lot with me, and if he didn't, when I went go to New York to work in the city, I came by Trailways bus. Someone would always meet me at the Port Authority and take me over to Ralph's apartment. I worked lots of times. I'd work at Gertie's Folk City a week or 2 weeks at a time, doing either opening act or just playing the job straight there. It was scary. I was as green as a green apple as far as the city. Country boy,
yeah,
really.
Oh, yeah, sure.
As the old-timers used to say, a hayseed for sure. But the scary part finally and the adventure finally got over with, and that road, well, it became a job.
Yeah,
music,
I see what
music,
you mean.
A good audience, I love.
You know, I think there's always clubs who... Not maybe not many, but there's always some clubs willing to take advantage of a performer. And I would guess that someone who was blind was a more likely target if they didn't have people who were watching out for them. Would you ever have any problems with that?
I was glad when my son Merle started on the road with me, because if we went to a place and they didn't treat me too good, Dad, we won't come back here anymore. And that was the end of it. I'd tell Manny, I'd tell Mr. Greenhill, don't book that anymore. That was the end of it. We didn't hit too many places that they weren't really decent to us, but once in a great while there, of course I won't call any names because we're on nationwide radio, but we were in a few places where they treated you like pieces of used equipment, and that was the end of playing there. We just didn't do it again. That's the best thing you can do, you know, is not tolerate that. Just move away.
You mentioned your son Merle. Did you teach him how to play guitar?
No. Merle didn't show any interest in the guitar until he was 15. I was on my first concert tour, a little solo concert tour that spring. And about middle ways of it, Ralph called me and said, Doc, I've got some good news. And I said, well, lay it on me. And he said, Merle has started playing the guitar. His mother, Rosalie, started him on the guitar. She taught him his first chords and showed him how to play them, and a little bit about timing, and he just took it and went with it. And we met John Hurt for the first time that same summer. We went to the Berkeley Folk Festival, and Merle played backup guitar for me. He'd only been playing about 3 months, and he played backup guitar on the stage. And when we met John Hurt, Merle was enthralled by John's finger style on the guitar. And he took that and added a few little notions of his own, and that's where Merle's picking style, finger style, came from.
So he never felt that he had to work hard to differentiate his style from your style?
Merle, he once in a while he'd ask me for some pointers on a melody to a song or something, but Merle played his very own thing on the guitar. I don't think he even ever asked me how to hold the pick. He probably looked at the way I held it, but I never really sat down and taught him how you get this note or that note. I just played a song and sang it, and he jumped in there and learned the lead to it, like Summertime, for instance. I had heard a version of that, and I said, Merle, what do you think about learning this? And I played the thing about halfway through, and he said, gosh, I don't know, it sounds like it'd be hard. And so help me, in 5 minutes, he could play the lead to it. And when we did the recording, I'll say this about it, and then we'll move on. When we did the recording, the producer, Jack Clement, came running through and said, boys, don't touch it. It was the first take. He says, that one's the way it should be. And Merle said, well, it was spontaneous. And he said, Dad, I'll have to go back and memorize what I did. Those things happen in the studio a lot of time. You know, after you learn a song, you'll hear notes that you just reach for, and they're there. And you play things that you hadn't played before.
Yeah, I've noticed with a lot of musicians that they meet all these people who've memorized their licks, and they have no idea what they played. They were just being spontaneous, and everybody else goes and memorizes it. When your son Merle died, was it hard for you to go back on the road afterwards?
if you'll pardon a little intimacy here, I'll tell you something that happened or I wouldn't have. Between the time he was killed and his funeral, I dreamed I was in a dark desert, and it was so hot you couldn't breathe. And the sand was pulling me down like if you were in quicksand. And that big, strong hand reached back and said, come on, Dad, you can make it. And he brought me, led me out to where it was cool, but there was sunny, but there was a cool breeze. And I waked up and I thought, well, I'll try. And I took up the last job on that particular tour that we'd canceled. And my friend Jack Lawrence had been working some while Merle was off the road with us for quite a while, and Jack stayed on as the other guitarist. And I'm kind of glad I did. If I had stayed off the road a month, I never would have come back. It was so hard, you know. You couldn't know Terry, but it was really hard to go back out there without him.
But I guess that dream kind of gave you permission in a way to do it.
I believe it was godsend, I think, the dream was.
I want to play a record with you and Merle performing, and this is from an album you recorded together, the Doc Watson, Merle Watson guitar album, and this is Talking to Casey, and Merle Watson is featured on slide guitar. I've been using the word virtuoso today, and I would guess that one of the problems of being a virtuoso is that people want to hear you play fast all the time, to hear you really, you know, do the most difficult stuff that you can do.
Well, yeah, a lot of people do get into that, but usually if you have a big audience, you can't really take requests from the when you're on stage, so you just program your set and you season it with enough of that to keep the people who love the flashy things satisfied and kind of do a sensible set. I don't mind it if people like to hear the flat picking, and it does give you a boost to get a lot of yells and whistles and screams from the audience, you know, but I love the good solid music too, and most of the audience do, really. When it comes right down to it, they like to hear you, the whole scope of the thing. Being accused of being a virtuoso doesn't bother me as bad as people trying to put me on a pedestal, especially when they're my own age.
What do you mean by putting you on a pedestal?
Well, they act like you're a god or something, you know. Lord, I'm just people. Like everybody else, I do play the guitar, but I had to work awful hard at it to learn what I know.
Why is this more difficult for you to cope with if it's someone your own age saying that?
Because they know better. They should know that I'm people. if it's a high school age or a younger boy or a girl that does, I let them get away with it. You know, you let them down easy. You don't agree to it, but you let them down easy. But you think somebody up Doc Watson's age would know that Doc's just a normal human being that likes to pick the guitar. He's not a celebrity. I never have felt like I am, you know. And I don't know how to act like a politician.
Can I ask you a question that I hope you don't mind me asking? And if you do, don't answer it. A lot of performers who are blind wear dark glasses when they perform, and that's something you've never done.
I don't know why. I always hated, used to have had a good bit of light perception. Doesn't bother me now because most of it's gone. But the reflection off sunglasses, you know how it'll come in on the sides. I guess they make them now, it won't do it. But boy, they used to try to get me to wear them. I reckon they didn't like the way my eyes looked. A lot of people would say you ought to wear sunglasses. I hated them. I wouldn't do it. And I just never have worn them. I don't know if the blind that wear them, their eyes look really abnormal or what. I don't know. I never did care to wear them, just didn't do it.
Right.
No particular reason except what I told you.
Yeah, well, I could certainly understand that. I mean, I don't understand why they need to be worn by, I guess it's preference, just whether you want to wear them or not.
I suppose, yeah.
One last thing. You know, there's a really nice recording on the album that we heard earlier from the early 60s of you and your wife singing together. Does she still sing? Do you ever sing together?
She doesn't sing anymore or play anymore. The tragedy of losing Merle, Terry, has just about undone her. She does the office work there at home, but she's not Rosalie anymore. Bless her little heart. I don't know, sometimes I just want to cry. And, you know, especially when I'm away from her, I do, when I think about it. I try not to and try to encourage her what I can. But it's been tough on her, and she can't seem to get over the loss. The grief really has her yet.
Yeah, I can understand. Well, you'll be able to spend more time together when you retire. I regret we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for coming, for talking with us about music, and thank you very much, and I hope you have a good continuing year on the road.
I'll guarantee you it's been a pleasure.
Doc Watson speaking with Terry Gross in 1988.